Wake up, put on coffee, pour into cup, lighter out, smoke or vape maybe, work, break, smoke, eat, smoke, happy hour, beer, another. As a society, our relationships with vices is a complicated one, particularly when it comes to legal substances. And as the ever-evolving lenses of biological understanding, cultural approval, and social norms continue to shift, it raises a question. What does it mean to have a drink or take a drag? And what, in the end, are these substances doing to our brains? Nicotine and alcohol. One stimulant, the other a depressant. Both inextricably tied to the history of our species and the modern social construct. Both on a foundational level, used primarily as mood controllers. Alcohol is as old as human civilization itself. In ancient Egypt, China, the Americas, and Mesopotamia, alcoholic beverages were fermented from local commodity crops. And as empires rose and fell and generations turned into millennia, these alcoholic drinks remained a constant, a source of culture, of calories, and of social catalyst. Tobacco enjoyed a millennia-long history of cultivation in the Americas before spreading to the rest of the world, and by the 1800s was a global economic and social powerhouse. By the 1880s, in fact, tobacco excise tax accounted for 1/3 of internal revenue collected by the United States government. But what precisely does this seemingly innocuous plant do? We know it's addictive. We know it's dangerous, but what, on a fundamental level, happens to a brain when it comes in contact with that pungent smoke? This is nicotine, the primary active psychotropic ingredient in cigarettes and other tobacco products. Each cigarette provides the user with about 1.5 milligrams of nicotine, less than a couple of drops, but it's enough. In larger doses, nicotine can be deadly. It even has uses as a pesticide. But in these more controlled doses, its effect is more subtle. Once the smoke from the cigarette enters the lungs, the nicotine is absorbed by the bloodstream and transported to the brain nearly instantaneously. Nicotine acts as a sort of false neurotransmitter, increasing brain activity and triggering the release of dopamine. Naturally, this creates a pleasurable, calming sensation. Alcohol works much in the same way, only in this case, instead of increasing brain activity, the ethanol molecules bind to the neurotransmitter GABA, therefore slowing everything down in the brain to a crawl. Particularly, it inhibits regions related to rational thought, memory, balance, and impulse control. And yes, it also increases some endorphins. So the reason people drink, the reasons people smoke, is fairly obvious. It's because they work. They calm us down, or they perk us up. Oftentimes when people in my practice talk to me about their alcohol consumption or their use of tobacco, they're quite nervous to talk with a physician about this. But I understand these substances enter into people's lives for a reason. Alcohol so commonly is used to help us with social anxiety or when we're feeling down or blue or can't sleep. It's something that almost immediately calms people down. I also like to hear when people started smoking. So often it's a period in their life where they were looking for more focus or energy or struggling with their mood. Almost always alcohol and nicotine come on board where people are trying to take care of some aspect of their mental health, even though that might sound a little counterintuitive, given the risks and the effects long-term we know of both alcohol and nicotine. And while the negative effects of both alcohol and tobacco in relation to overall body health as a whole are widely and wildly prevalent in both media and social discourse, its lingering effects on the brain tend to take a back seat. Increases in inflammation, for instance, are linked heavily to both smoking and drinking, as are rates of depression and other mental health disorders like depression. The bottom line is, these aren't effective treatments and in no way help us achieve our optimal mental health and mental fitness. And as the negative effects of these substances continue and grow and dependency increases, the feel-good effects grow thinner and thinner. With smoking, each puff represents less of a hit to the system than that one time before it. As nicotine receptors in the brain increase, the craving for each new dosage of the drug increases. This creates a self-fulfilling cycle that most find hard to break through. Likewise, alcohol fosters dependence, and the single Friday night stout no longer has the effect that it used to. That glass of Cabernet or Chardonnay turns into two or three to have the same effect. That's called tolerance. The central irony of both alcohol and nicotine comes into play when you realize that they both foster and exacerbate the very issues that they're meant to treat. Yes, treating an anxious or racing mind with a drink or two can mask these symptoms in the short term, but once the effect wears off, and it will more quickly than you think, psychological symptoms show back up. This sometimes mild, sometimes less mild withdrawal is linked to measurable swings in mood, increased anxiety, and agitation. Sound familiar? And whereas a lifestyle that completely avoids cigarettes and other nicotine products has received universal endorsement across the medical community, there exists a strange, borderline, irresponsible distaste for asking people to teetotal entirely. The paradigm of the responsible social drinker. But the line for moderate drinking is probably less than you think. The CDC defines it on average as a single drink for a woman or two for men per day. And if you drink the hard stuff, that drink's smaller than the one you may be picturing. And then there are other, even more ubiquitous drugs. Consider caffeine, the most widely used modern stimulant. The average adult male consumes over 250 milligrams of it per day, and the effects on the brain can be tremendous. While the half-life of caffeine is just 6 hours, consuming caffeinated beverages, especially afternoon, leads to significant interruptions in sleep and the way that your brain cycles through sleep. All to say that cup of joe or a cup of tea in the morning really is having profound effects on your brain throughout the day, not just when you're feeling its stimulating effects. And let's not forget, caffeine's not just in coffee. You find stimulating molecules and natural caffeines in lots of tea and green tea, or even dark chocolate. And while this is much less stimulation than you get in a cup of coffee, if you're struggling with anxiety or energy, looking at the ways that your food contains caffeine or other stimulants is a huge and important step. In fact, in my clinical practice, one of the first things I do with patients after taking their history is understanding their use of caffeine and other natural stimulants. And for most patients, really recommending that they rein that in and get control of these unnatural ways of getting energy, and instead swap them out for the types of techniques we're going to talk about in this course. Speaking about unnatural energy, no discussion on healing the modern brain would be complete without mentioning sugar. Sugar is in almost everything these days. You'd be hard-pressed to walk down a grocery aisle and find a packaged food item without added sugar. So let me cut right to the chase. Sugar is not brain food. And while the brain is wired to crave sugar, and researchers even categorize sugar as addictive, eating simple carbohydrates, think potato chips, pastries, soda, and other sugary foods, actually causes increased inflammation and a greater risk of clinical depression and anxiety.
In later modules, we'll cover the specifics of nutritional psychiatry and how to properly nourish your brain for better mental health.
This is the part where you're probably expecting me to give you a lecture on hard teetotaling. Instead of laying down hard rules, I encourage mindfulness. Remember, mental fitness is about asking the question, what can I do to be more content and have a life I enjoy more? So ask yourself, why do I drink? Or why do I smoke? It's a harder question to answer than it first appears. The obvious first answer is because I like the way it feels. And fair. Again, the only reason people use drugs and alcohol of any kind is because they work, because in the short term, they help us feel better. But consider this on a deeper level, on a net level. Would you feel better if you cut down? Would you feel better maybe if you stopped entirely? Have you thought about taking a break for a little while or giving yourself and your brain the experience of a life that's free of nicotine and alcohol? Here's my prescription. If you're struggling with your mood, or you're experiencing brain fog, or you're simply not feeling your best, if you're struggling with significant anxiety, I encourage you to begin thinking about taking some time off of your substance of choice. By removing the mood controllers for even just a few days, you'll begin to better understand and begin to better conceptualize the workings of your brain and the effect of these substances on it. Certainly, as you try and titrate down from alcohol or using nicotine, you're going to encounter some of the effects of going into a chemical withdrawal. But those short-term challenges, I'm sure, are going to reveal long-term benefits for you and for your brain, and most importantly, for your overall sense of mental health and mental fitness. Here are some key points from this module. Those suffering from anxiety and depression often use substances like caffeine, alcohol, nicotine, or illicit drugs in response to their symptoms. In reality, people use substances like alcohol and nicotine because they are effective in the short term. Often they enter into our lives when we are struggling and looking for ways to feel better in the short term. But this doesn't come without a cost to the brain. Nicotine, alcohol, and other substances of abuse are not effective solutions in the long term. Rather, the research shows that they are associated with inflammation, a myriad of health consequences, and more symptoms of depression and anxiety. For long-term mental fitness and optimal brain health, minimizing alcohol and other substances is best for full recovery from anxiety and depression, a concept known as harm reduction. Caffeine is the most consumed psychoactive substance in the world. While a cup of coffee or tea can improve focus and wakefulness, it can also lead to interruptions in sleep and feelings of anxiety. Pay careful attention to the sources and timing of your caffeine intake. If you're struggling with your mood or anxiety, chances are that substances like nicotine, caffeine, and alcohol could be part of the picture. My main recommendation is to consider the role of these substances in your life and consider taking some time off to better understand their impact on your mental health and mental fitness. Be sure to review the resources in this module to discover ways to better understand your relationship with these substances and find ways to minimize their negative impact on your mental health. Finally, I hope you hear my encouragement to seek professional help if you are struggling significantly in this arena.